Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum, and you can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter with hashtag InforumSF. I'm Brad Stone, Senior Technology Writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Tonight we are joined by Reid Hoffman and Brian Chesky, two extremely accomplished internet founders. Reid is currently a partner at the venture capital firm Greylock. He played an instrumental role in the birth of PayPal, but he's probably best known as the co-founder and chairman of LinkedIn. Brian is the co-founder and CEO of Airbnb, an online service that matches people seeking vacation rentals and other short-term accommodations with those who have rooms, apartments, houses, or other unique spaces to rent. They're here to talk about their companies, how to steer through the challenges facing every startup, and how to harness the power of the internet to succeed. Let's get started. Reid, Brian, you guys are on a panel together for a reason. You work together. Reid, of course, who is a very successful angel investor who invested in Facebook and Zynga, also invested in Airbnb, and is an advisor and board observer to the company. So I'd like to hear the story of how you guys met, and Reid, what your first reaction was to a proposition that's hard for some people to get, that people should rent their homes to perfect strangers.
Well, I had heard about Airbnb for a while, and it had been pitched to me as a couch surfing thing. And I was like, couch surfing is not that interesting. And then a mutual friend, Brian's and I, Keith or Boy, said, this is really exciting. You need to meet these guys. And I was like, okay, great. And so we met at a weekend at the Greylock offices. And Brian started going through the pitch. And about 3 minutes into it, I said, pause. I'm really interested in investing. I want to hear the rest of the pitch. But already, I get what it is you're thinking about. And this is much more interesting than what I thought before. Because the idea of essentially transforming the notion of this massive illiquid asset that exists in most of our lives in terms of the a room, an apartment, a house, a unique space, into something that could actually be essentially a peer-to-peer marketplace is just one of the killer ideas. And marketplaces are one of the things that I really focus on. And so that was like, I'd already gotten references on Brian and his co-founders, Nate and Joe. And I was like, okay, I'm ready. And that was from my side. I don't know what was from your side.
I had wanted to get Reid involved for the longest time. We started in late 2007, early 2008. We finally got Reid involved in 2010. But there are only a few people in the world I really wanted to get involved, and Reid was one of them. And he had a few characteristics I was looking for. I really wanted somebody that had seen a lot of great companies and invested in a lot of great companies. And he was an early investor in Facebook, an early investor in Zynga. But he was also, like, the key attribute I look for in investors is somebody that can give you more than just money. Well, if they can give you more than just money, they actually have to have been in your shoes, ideally. And Reid had been. He had been a founder. And if you actually look at how many venture capitalists have been founders of companies that are in consumer web and have been close to all the other consumer websites, you end up with a very short list of which Reid's on. And there weren't many other people. And everyone just said amazing things about him. And as soon as we met, like, he instantly knew the right questions to ask.
And where is Airbnb at this time? You had come through the Y Combinator startup program.
Yeah, so we had a nice kind of interesting story, which I can maybe tell about a little bit later. But at this point, in January 2009, we did this program called Y Combinator. It's a really cool program where they give you $20,000. And over the course of 3 months, it's like a sink or swim. You see it with $20,000 what you can do. Can you create this company and basically get a product to market and then get funding? At the end of Y Combinator, you do this thing called Demo Day where you pitch all these investors. We ended up taking funding from Sequoia at that point. And then exactly a year later, we were looking for our next big round of institutional funding. And Sequoia Capital's one of the extremely prestigious firms in Silicon Valley. And so when you have them, you're thinking, well, who else can actually add value on top of this? And so we were thinking, well, who's somebody who's actually operational that started a company? And Reid, LinkedIn was like a great model for us.
So Reid, you were involved in PayPal in the very early days. You co-founded LinkedIn. Compare what you see as the size of Airbnb's opportunity against some of the other companies you've been involved with?
Well, the ideal for the companies that both I would invest in and especially dedicate time to is, in a sense, there is no limit. That the transformation that you could have in terms of the numbers of millions of people and the impact you can have. I mean, there's obviously, you know, there's the global population, there's a limit to market cap. So, of course, theoretically there are limits, but a huge enduring institution that can really change people's lives. And so if you actually think about it, the vast majority of people have the most of their economics tied up in their space, right? It's where the largest asset is. And to enable that into some liquidity on the host side, and on the traveler side, to give a much wider range of different possible higher value experiences, more unique experiences, social experiences, you know, the prospects for where it could go are huge. And so, yes, PayPal, payment OS for the world, you know, the global payment OS, you know, LinkedIn, how every individual can transform their professional life and, you know, and their ability to kind of to be effective in work. And, you know, Zynga, you know, kind of connecting the world through games. All of them massive, massive scale. And that's the kind of thing I look for, which is the reason why 3 minutes in, I was like, oh, this is huge.
How often do you guys talk? And Brian, how do you use Reed's expertise?
So we definitely talk every week, and it really depends. I think a startup has these kind of cycles. It never goes like this. It kind of goes like it's calm, and then things go crazy, and then it's calm, and then things get really relaxed, and it gets crazy again. And so it's less about a cadence of weekly check-ins, and it's more about there's a whole bunch of things going on. I need to talk to you like right now, and the pace is pretty insane. And we really talk across the board. And one of the great things about him is I can talk to him about general product stuff, and we have product meetings about like what we're supposed to be doing with the product. We talk about kind of all sorts of stuff related to the law or stuff related to business or hiring or scaling. And to give you guys a perspective of like kind of where we're at as a company, right now we have over 200 employees working around the world. It's a pretty good-sized company. But a year ago, only a year ago, we were 13 people, and we were working out of a 3-bedroom apartment. So that's pretty crazy. And next year, I don't know how many people we'll have, but I'm sure we'll have more than 1,000. 13 people, 200, more than 1,000. There's a lot of lessons along the way. Like, there's a lot. And like going from 20 people to 40 people, there's a lot of lessons just in that jump.
And one of the things that I love about Brian and his co-founders is I never have a sit-down session with Brian where he's not like, okay, what else do I need to learn here? What do I need to know in order to go down this path fast? And that's exactly the kind of entrepreneur that you essentially want to back, because it's the, I know there's landmines, I know there's bumps, I know that this thing is coming, and I know there's great opportunity. How do I tackle that? And, you know, one of the famous expressions from Andy Grove is, only the paranoid survive. Well, it's not necessarily paranoia about death. It's a constant, I know there's more things to learn. How do I learn them as fast and as effectively as possible is a key entrepreneurial
thing. Do young CEOs tend to make more mistakes in that kind of situation?
I don't know about more. I think all entrepreneurs, especially in high-growth circumstances, tend to make mistakes. And it's really not a question of do you make mistakes or not as much as do you avoid making the really fatal ones and do you correct really fast is more than, you know, kind of an avoidance of mistakes. Because any business that is effective, that is in the Internet, each space, each business kind of defines its own space and becomes somewhat kind of sui generis in terms of what it, how it creates. It's of itself in Latin for whatever silly expression that is. And so that means you have to learn your own lessons. So a pure playbook from, oh yes, now we turn to page 25 and it says run the, it's not like that. It's, you're inventing the playbook per business. And so that process is a learning process.
So in 2007, you gave up the CEO spot at LinkedIn. And, of course, the conventional wisdom about founder CEOs has really changed a lot in the last couple of years, as guys like Mark Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs really proved what, you know, the strength of the founder CEO. Do you look at a guy like Brian and wish a little bit that you remain CEO of LinkedIn?
Not really, but part of that is because with Jeff, I actually – one of the highest points of praise I think we say about Jeff at LinkedIn is that he's acting like a founder CEO, e.g., he owns the mission. He's driven a long term. It's, you know, how the decisions you make are fundamental to product or fundamental to what are you building out, and not as kind of a generic, oh yes, I'm managing the P&L and here's what the budget needs to look like and that kind of stuff. It's driving that product forward. And I think the really key thing, I do think staying involved as a founder is important, but the key thing is how does the team work? And you know, one of the things I recently said about Praise and Jeff is
Jeff Weiner,
Jeff Weiner,
LinkedIn
yes,
CEO.
Exactly. You know, now actually I feel like if I wanted to take a vacation, I could, whereas before I couldn't.
Brian, you're on an amazing ride. Do you ever feel out of your element?
No, I don't. I absolutely love the challenges. And the great thing about what we're doing is, like, when we first had this idea, the first challenge was, like, how do we actually, like, turn this into a company? And every step along the way, like, it's been a challenge. And the key thing is, like, a company grows, and then you grow. And the key is that the company doesn't grow faster than you do. And we constantly get challenged because if things are growing exponentially, then you need to grow exponentially as well. So the question is, well, how do you grow with a company that's doubling in size every few months? That's becoming, you know, we're now in 19,000 cities. And the answer is you have to surround yourself. Like one of my friends said the other day, you are the average of your five closest friends. Or maybe you're the average of the five people that you take counsel to on a daily basis. So, you know, if the challenges get bigger, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't rise to them, but the people around you need to be people that can handle those challenges. And so having somebody like Reed with us, and then we also have, you know, Jeff Jordan and Mark Andreessen just joined the team as well from Andreessen Horowitz, and we have a bunch of other really great advisors as well. You know, those are the things that allow us to grow. Every step of the way, there's like no manual that in fact, Reed once said, starting a company is like jumping off a cliff and assembling the airplane on the way down. And that's what it feels like, right? And there's no manual. Like, what do I do? But what you do is you have these, like, phones you can call up. Like, what do I do now? What do I do now?
Lifelines.
Lifelines. And they're lifelines. And you do have them. And the truth is, you take some solace in two things. Number one, there are some things you're about to do that everyone's done before that started a company. I need to hire a general counsel. I need to hire a CFO. What do I do? Well, these are the things you need to know. But there's other things that only you know. In fact, like, I would argue we as founders know more about the market we're in than anybody else in the world. No one else knows because we're creating that market. So that market is what we make of it. So, you know, and that's a key thing about being a founder is only you can see around the corner, but then there's things that like, you know, like essentially scaling a management team. Going from a bunch of us in an apartment in like jeans and without our shoes on in front of a laptop working out of a kitchen to suddenly in an office having to build out a full-time management team with different pillars of the business, that is a transition that you need to take close advice to know how to scale.
How have the established players like hotel chains or vacation rental services, how have they reacted to Airbnb? I know in certain cases they're not pleased that you don't pay the same taxes or have to conform to the same code requirements.
So we haven't had much conversation with most of these groups, and I think at the end of the day, what we're doing is actually something that's been happening for generations. You know, the vacation rental market is something that's an $80 billion market worldwide, and there's a public company that just went public, HomeAway. So they've already proven this market out. People have been renting their homes on Craigslist for like since the 1995 when Craigslist started. So it's actually a funny story. When we first came up with a concept, I told my mom, and I think my mom was like a lot of people who they first hear about the concept. They're like, "Are you crazy? I would never do that." And it just seemed like a new idea. And I remember telling my grandfather about the concept. And I remember my grandfather looked at me and said, "Of course." And I mean, "What do you mean, of course?" And he said, "Well, that's how I used to travel when I was a kid." And I think that, you know, we're bringing back this idea that's much older. And the idea isn't just staying in people's homes. This idea is sharing. This idea that, like, you know, we have these extra resources, 25% of what you spend probably is your home or your rent if you're an average American, and that we can create a more efficient environment. And, you know, I think when things are new, you know, people are unfamiliar, they're not sure how to think about them. But I think, you know, here in San Francisco even, I think people are getting pretty comfortable.
I actually think one of the things that Brian said is a very important lesson for how to think about both being an entrepreneur and investing, which is the really, truly disruptive and big ideas are both contrarian and right. And so when you're actually cross-checking with your network about, hey, is this a good idea, it's actually usually a very worrying sign when everybody says, oh, yeah, that's a good idea, because usually you haven't discovered something that's really wrong. So, for example, when I was founding LinkedIn, about two-thirds of my friends told me I was out of my mind. Right? So it's the, no, I see something before other people see it, and you start building out, and then it builds into something that's instrumental. And I think that's the exact thing that's
happening. Why did they think you were out of your mind?
Well, for several reasons. One is they thought, well, you know, no one would ever, like, first person in a network, valueless. Second person in a network, valueless. Third person in a network, valueless. How are you going to get to the relevant kind of size? Another one is, you won't be all people, both senior people and young people. The senior people thought it would be all young people. The young people thought it would be all senior people. You know, those sorts of things. And you have to kind of work those through, and you have to have a vision of what you're doing. And that's exactly what Brian and his co-founders
are doing. One other thing, you know, my mom was representative of a lot of people that assumed that our site was going to be something that young backpacking kind of bohemian types would use. And the funny thing is that if we have an archetype for a user on our site, well, the majority of our users are women. The average age, I think, is like late 30s. And we're very popular among the baby boomer group and like retirees. And, you know, we weren't expecting that either. You know, oftentimes you build something to solve your own problem. And we started this company because I was living here in San Francisco and I had $1,000 in the bank account and rent was $1,150. So I have a math problem, basically. I have to make rent. And so we created a design conference coming to San Francisco, and all the hotels in the city were sold out. These designers needed places to stay. But more importantly, I think they're coming to this conference because they wanted to connect. They wanted to share an experience with another designer. And so we said, we'll create a bed and breakfast at the conference, but I just moved up there. I didn't have any beds. But we had three air beds in the closet. We called it the air bed and breakfast. And if you would tell me that I'd be sitting here because of that crazy weekend, the goal back then was to make rent, but the lesson was that we tried to solve our own problem. And our bet was this. If we solve our own problem and we're ordinary guys, and mean, by definition of we're ordinary, there's a lot of other people like us. So if we can solve a problem for ourselves, as many other people like us, then we have a really big market and we solve the problem for a really big market.
Give us a sense for the volume, the rooms per night that you're booking now.
So we don't talk about too much about the volume. We've done over 2 million nights booked so far. We have almost 100,000 properties, including, I think, like 6 or 7,000 just in New York City alone and a couple thousand here in San Francisco.
So obviously one of your big challenges is building trust in Airbnb,
yeah.
Building trust in the platform and allowing users to have trust in other members of the service. Talk a little bit about how you design trust into the service.
You know, trust is the cornerstone of our market. And if we are successful, Airbnb becomes your trusted profile online. Or you can almost say your trusted profile offline in the real world. And so when we first built the site, I'll kind of give you the evolution of how it all came about. We first built the site, we said, we don't want this to be a cash business. We want to facilitate the payments, make sure everything's taken care of. But you're going to send money to somebody, you want to know who they are. So we built profiles. Well, if you have profiles and you're handling the transactions, then we can hold your credit card. We can know the information about your credit card. And then we can also create a review system. So we have a review system, a two-sided review system, that only if you book, you can leave a review. It's a two-sided reputation system. Well, if you handle money and you have reviews, people want to be able to call customer support as a problem. So we instituted a 24-hour customer support line. And since then, we've done additional things like we allow you to connect to Facebook, verify your phone number, verify your email address. We actually have a team of 1,000 photographers that have photographed almost 20,000 homes. They verified the homes, photographed the homes. So we have a whole list of these trust and safety features. And I think that that is one of the cornerstones of our innovation.
So a lot of people here may know that this summer you guys had a terrible situation. A user in San Francisco had her house absolutely ransacked, some of her property stolen. Reid, let me put you in the very uncomfortable position of addressing, you know, how you think Airbnb handled that, whether any mistakes were made.
Well, I actually think Airbnb handled it really well. I mean, one of the challenges in high-growth companies is there's always been a long list of projects that they wanted to do, and they're kind of triaging between them as they go through. And what happened was first, like, okay, we help catch a person, put them in jail. Oh, wait, we need to do a lot more than that. And the whole company spun up into how does the whole company work on trust and safety in the next 6 weeks? What are all the things we can put in place? Because what matters most is that trust. And so they literally went from concept execution on the Airbnb guarantee in weeks, right, which is the kind of thing that's great and wonderful about startups and a whole company and founders, you know, moving intently on a project. And, you know, this is familiar to me because when we were doing PayPal, we had a similar set of, you know, careening kind of things, which is like, well, are we a bank? And, you know, is the structure of how we're holding the funds, the right thing for the right protection of the users, what's going to happen with competing with BillPoint on eBay, you know, all these kinds of things, which were, you know, what was our business model, right, for a number of months was actually an open question. Never been an open question with Airbnb, but for PayPal it was an open question. And what happens when you, this is what I was meaning earlier when I say you learn your way through the unique problem. If you have a high clock speed and say, look, what matters is the trust of the user, and we're going to solve this, and we're going to solve it really quick and decisively, it's great. So, you know, basically, you know, a day or two of looking at this, the team spun up. I literally visited the office. They put a whiteboard that was in the center of the entire office that literally every single person in the company's name was assigned to a trust and safety project with when are we going to ship it, how are we going to communicate it, how are we going to put it in place, how is it going to operate. It was great.
Brian, talk a little bit about going through that episode and having the public spotlight shined on you guys.
I think it made us a better company. You know, you constantly innovate based on your experiences. And in the early days, we got signals from customers saying we want to have profiles, we want to have reviews, we want to have payments. We built all these different things. We had a roadmap of other things we wanted to do. And I think this event, in a way, was a wake-up call to get way ahead of it. You know, I mean, we had at this point done a couple million nights booked without an incident like this. So first of all, I thought, you know, the numbers were really in our favor. If you take 2 million of car rides, 2 million flights, 2 million anything, you know, you're going to have some challenges. But, you know, that being said, it was a wake-up call. It said we need to use this as an opportunity. We're going to use this as a way to get down, or we can use this opportunity to become better. And the team came together, and we made really ambitious plans. And the guarantee Reed refers to is you get, if you list on our website, you get a $50,000 guarantee against theft, vandalism, or damage on our site. And we basically had a huge brainstorm, all the different things. Plus, we had a whole roadmap of things we wanted to push. And, yeah, I would say it just made us a better company.
I guess I wonder, you know, we have sort of 10 or 15 years of knowledge about building trust in online communities. You know, but the difference is with eBay, if you get swindled, you get a fake iPod, or maybe you don't get your product at all. With Airbnb, you know, a stranger's wearing your clothes and climbing into bed with you at 2 in the morning. Are there really ways to make people comfortable with this and to protect against, you know, what frankly could be the worst case scenario lurking out there?
Well, I think structurally, and you know, Brian will obviously answer this too, but I think structurally one of the things is it means you have to be much more attentive to how you build the trust in the marketplace. So, you know, one of the things back in PayPal times, one of the funniest fraud thing that I saw was a person described a PlayStation 2 box in exact detail and auctioned it. And the person buying it thought they bought a PlayStation 2. And so, but you know, at the end of the day, like we gave them their money back and all the rest of the stuff. But you know, as you mentioned, it's not a big issue. However, of course, when you're dealing with people's space and belongings or else, you have to be much more careful. But that just means a much higher level of transparency, of reputation information, and navigating it. I think that's what the company has spent the summer massively gearing up on.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a number of really important features we built recently. One is social connections. We allow you, I think, like, here's another way of saying it. We allow you to decide how adventurous you want to be. And you can start with this way. You can connect to Facebook and say, I only want to stay with people who are friends of my friends, or people who went to the same school I went to, fellow alumni. You can go a little bit further and say, I only want to stay with people that are friends of my friends or people who have a positive review. And so you can start to self-select. And the interesting thing that happens is a lot of people come in to their network less adventurous, saying, I do want to only stay with friends of friends. And as they use the site, they realize, because you know there's a lot of built-in trust and safety features into our site, the fact that we collect, you know, payment information from the traveler, we have verify information from the host. It's kind of like a well-lit street, a really well-lit street. A lot less unscrupulous activity is going to happen. And you know, I think, you know, we allow you to connect to your LinkedIn network or your Twitter feed, and all these things I think start to make dramatic progress. And every day, millions of people meet and live together on like Gumtree, other eBay classified websites, Craigslist, and you know, so. And if you take that as baseline and you imagine what we've built on top of that, I think it becomes pretty interesting.
Reed, it took you 6 years at LinkedIn to raise $100 million. You went public after 9 years. Brian has gone and raised more than $100 million in 2 years and the company reportedly is valued at $1 billion. What is going on here, and is it good for innovation in the Valley, and is it good for building companies in a slow, steady way?
Well, I think one of the things we specialize in Silicon Valley is never really being that slow and steady. One of the things I say about Silicon Valley pacing as a region and as a state of mind is we kind of have two speeds, which is all ahead and stop, right? And so it's really a question of what the all ahead pace is right for particular companies. And some, for example, like one of the investments we made recently is coupons.com at Greylock has been building over, you know, well over 10 years. And it's just now coming to the right stage of doing that. And that was a very intelligent way of transforming the coupons industry. LinkedIn is more intermediate to that, which was, well, you know, people immediately got social. They started beginning to figure out about how professional networks can affect the way that they invest in themselves, you know, figure out which skills are important, which connections, how to track what the industry is happening, how they could do their job better, these sorts of things. And so it's more immediate. Airbnb, it's like, all right, well, this is, you know, wide open, massive, the marketplace for space, right? Let's move hard at that. I mean, one of the things that the company has already been tackling is massive international challenge, because how do we do this globally? And that puts in a huge amount of work to do that. It's part of why the company has grown a lot in the last year.
Yeah, and it's funny you say it happened so fast, because every day I was working, I'm like, why isn't it happening faster? That was probably the biggest complaint I had in the early days. Why isn't it happening faster? And I look back and I'm like, oh my God, it actually happened ridiculously fast. You know, when you're starting a company, it never goes the pace you want or the pace you expect. You start it and you have this, you imagine everything to be linear. I'm going to do this, then this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. And you're imagining it like steps, and they're progressive. And you start, you build it, and you think everyone's going to care, and no one cares. And it's like even your friends. Our first 100 users, I was related to, or maybe Joe was related to. Those were our first users, which is great, though. It actually turned out to be really good that we were so unpopular in the very beginning, because I had the opportunity that I could meet every one of our early customers. I actually think it made us a better company. If we took off in the early days, I would have never known all of them. But the early days, we were so unpopular, we had so few users, that I got to meet every single one of them. And I literally, met them. Like, we took off in New York City. We had, 100 people in New York. So Joe and I, you know, we had three founders, but Joe and I would fly to New York, go door-to-door meeting our users. When we stayed in New York, we'd stay with our users, which I thought was pretty novel. When you buy an iPhone, Steve Jobs doesn't come and stay in your couch. But I did, so, you know, I thought that was pretty cool. And you really get to meet your customers. And so it happens really slow, and then it has this accumulating effect. And at some point, and I think it was last fall, we're in our three-bedroom apartment, and we were working in an apartment for 2 years. I went from 4 people to 13 people from year 1 to year 2, and Reed remembers this. And by the end of last year, we had 20 or so people, and then all of a sudden, it was this year that it just kind of started taking off, law of big numbers. And now is the time where you really start to be thankful. Like, I always wondered when people said, you need to have, really smart investors, value add. And I appreciate it back then, but it's now that I really appreciate it when we're going from, 200 to, 400 people in a few months.
One of the things, actually, I think you should go into, Brian, part of being a good founder is you're focused on the product, you're focused on the experience of the user. You're like, how does this really go? And one of the things that was, it was kind of the, oh, yeah, this is the reason why I invested in this guy. You want to talk about living on basically Airbnb?
So really funny story. So, you know, we started this company to rent out this apartment one weekend. And it's pretty funny because pretty soon we start hiring these people and they start working out of our apartment. So I hire, a couple engineers that are working in my living room. The living room gets full. So then we have another bedroom that the roommate moves out of. So we have customer support working out of a bedroom. And then we have sales working in the kitchen. I actually remember a girl one time took a phone call from the bathroom. The guy's like, are you in a cave? She's like, no, I'm in a bathroom, thank you. And at some point, we're running out of space. We're doing interviews in stairwells because you can't be in an earshot. And so I remember Joe and I are roommates. We're in our own bedrooms, and we're thinking to ourselves, we need another room. We can't get an office in time. So Joe and I pulled straws. I got the short straw, and I said, I guess I'm moving out. So I moved out. I got rid of everything in my room. We turned into a meeting room, and I said, well, where am I going to live? And the natural thing, if you're here in San Francisco and you need to play in a full-time place to stay, at least a couple years ago, you would have said Craigslist. I said, I found an Airbnb. Cannot go to Craigslist. I got to use Airbnb. So I'm looking at all these places, and we didn't have sublets at the time. Now you can rent a place by the month in Airbnb, but back then it was only by the night. I'm looking at all these places thinking I could stay here for 6 months or here for 6 months. And as I'm starring all these places saying, this is nice, this is nice, this is nice, I said, it'd be kind of cool to stay in all of them. And that's what I did. I literally, for almost a year, lived on Airbnb in San Francisco. And every 3 to 5 nights, I stayed in a different family in a different neighborhood in San Francisco. I learned all the issues about our website. I probably learned issues about the neighborhood. I felt like I'd run for mayor at the end of it. I was learning like what the education problems were and like who was angry about their water. But it was like, that is how you know, your customers aren't going to email you the things that are truly important. You almost have to like be with them and get that really subtle signal. And I lived on it. And even a month, 2 months ago, I lived on a 125-foot ship. A Norwegian icebreaker that was docked in Iceland and came over here, and I lived on that for the month in the captain's quarters. So it's all about like living your product. And if you work at Facebook, it's pretty easy to use your product every day. If you are using a site that allows you to go somewhere else in the world, you got to be creative.
But now you have more permanent living conditions.
I'm back to the apartment at least for now, but it's for my next adventure.
And Reed, you have no plans to start living the Airbnb lifestyle?
No.
we're still in the talk.
Yes.
Talk.
Then,
let us know if you're renting out your place.
Well, I'm planning on taking one of my trips to the UK and renting the castle that's on the site. But you know, that's a future plan.
Is the castle have Wi-Fi?
I don't know.
But you know what, Brian? You made me think of something. You guys both build businesses in markets. LinkedIn with job hunting, Airbnb with rentals, that were serviced quite well early on by Craigslist, a company that proudly does not innovate, has not changed in over 10 years. Do you attribute some of your success, some of the opportunity you found, to the fact that this early mover, you know, was created by kind of some eccentric guys and didn't really develop the property?
Well, Craig's a friend. I really like Craig.
Yeah, I think you'd admit that Craigslist hasn't changed a lot.
I think all technology properties, if they don't innovate on at least a kind of revolutionary 2 to 3 year cycle, begin to have problems. And that's one of the things that's interesting about driving good tech strategy. And so, you know, by the logic of that, I think it'd be useful for Craigslist to innovate. I think that both companies could actually have driven basically their full market, however strong Craigslist essays or not. And it basically comes down to, is, you know, a huge amount of the Airbnb is actually when you move, it's not, as Brian has been doing, it's not like I'm moving around San Francisco. It's I'm going to Paris, I'm going to New York, I'm going, you know. And that kind of crossing usually is not the thing that happens as much with Craigslist. And so there's a very wide opportunity there. And, you know, Airbnb just has great design in terms of how to do the reputation system, how to make the information really available and transparent for making decisions. And then in the case of LinkedIn, not only is it about, it's not job listings, it's the network, it's the professional identity and these sorts of things, none of which would, you know, maybe they could have been built on Craigslist, but it's not even close.
I think it's really important that you change faster than the world around you. And the world around us changes extremely fast. So that means that as a startup, you know, as a company, you know, you have to continually press forward. And it's interesting because no matter what space you're in, there's oftentimes an opportunity. It's like, oh, somebody's already done that before. It's already been done. And it's been done, but like there's so many people have such specific needs. And Craigslist is a very general utility. And it's great as a general utility. But there's also very specific needs and use cases. You can almost say there's like gaps in between all the categories. And each one of those is an opportunity.
So it's probably a testament to Airbnb's visibility that you guys find yourself every so often in controversy. So let me hit two of them real quick. Because we're talking about Craigslist, there was a report that you guys had employed a contractor to send, you know, messages that might be considered spam to users of Craigslist to bring them over to Airbnb. Talk a little bit about that and why,
yeah,
you know, why you did that.
So when you're a young company, you try a lot of different strategies to grow. And one of the things we tried, we did a lot of things. We went met our users. We did professional photography. And one of the things we did is we hired some contract salespeople, and it was a lesson in management that you should be very close to the people you're managing. These people were remote. I didn't give them a lot of rules. I said, find really interesting properties on Craigslist. People are interested in listing, and but there weren't a lot of instructions. And they kind of took that a little bit far and contacted people that were not open to being contacted. And we were alerted about this kind of a bit later, and we since terminated it. But the really important thing about it was that they were never really that effective, which is probably why we didn't really know much about what they were doing. It was just kind of this one or two people in the background. And, you know, it's just one of the lessons you learn. And one of the lessons you learn is you have to be very close, provide constant management and guidance to the people you're working with. And if you kind of just leave them to do their own thing, well, then you have to know them really, really well if you're going to give them a lot of autonomy. And so one of the lessons I gave is I don't want to necessarily micromanage people, but if I don't want to micromanage people, that means I have to have enormous amount of trust in the people that I hire, and they can't be remote. And if they're going to be remote, then I need to know everything they're doing, but you can't combine the two.
I think a classic challenge for high-growth startups is you're running really fast, and you end up stumbling over uneven ground. You know, so early at PayPal, we realized that, oh, shoot, some fraudsters are basically trying to use this as a way to collect money and defraud people. Okay, we really need to fix that. And it, some instances happened, but then you're like, okay, study the data, fix it, make it work. And that's how you build, you know, trust.
Of course, the other recent issue was around your latest funding round and the report that you and your founders took some money off the table as a dividend, not selling any shares. And of course, you know, it's emblematic of what's happening in Silicon Valley now, where there is lots of liquidity for executives, employees, and investors of non-public startups. Talk a little bit about, you know, that decision and some of the criticisms.
So I'm going to jump in here. This is Reed for the radio. Basically, one of the things is companies don't usually reflect any of their private financing things in the public because it's just not constructive. I actually personally looked through this, and actually I thought everything was fine and the press stuff was overblown. And there were actually some shares that were sold as per the normal thing of, look, in order to have a secondary thing. And the company's plans, both for its current employees and for its what it does for the future of employees, are perfectly solid. But I don't think it's, I mean, my encouragement to Brian would say, hey, next question, just because these are the kind of things that, you know, the infrastructure of the company you don't normally answer.
Well, then let's just talk generically. Has the early liquidity for startups that's available to founders, has that been good for innovation?
I think so for the following reason, which is as an investor and as a company, you want to incent the founders and the execs to go long. And so getting a, like, I would, if Brian had said, I want zero, I would have pushed him very hard to take a little, because part of what that means is we can build a company here that's worth multiple billions of dollars, transforms, you know, millions of people's lives, and we should go all the way and go long. And part of how you align incentives between investors and the entire company's way of doing that is by saying, okay, I can afford a house. Right, like I can afford a house now I still really want to go long. And that's, I think, really, really good for aligning interests for long-term institution creation.
I think this is kind of how I think about the business, and this might kind of also answer the question. I have a few people I admire, kind of role models that I look at, like kind of both, so two people no longer alive, Walt Disney and Steve Jobs. And everyone in the Valley seems to like kind of idolize Steve Jobs, but probably for good reason. And the reason I love both of them is because they dedicated their entire life basically to a single company. Of course, Steve went to Next, and he also did Pixar. But if I'm successful as an entrepreneur, then I could look back in my life and be able to say Airbnb was this huge thing that outlived me and kind of something that kind of lived beyond my generation. And I have absolutely no idea if that will actually happen. That's admittedly just the dream. That is the dream. But, you know, when that story came out, the message I wanted to get across was that we are truly here for the long run. If I am successful, then that is the kind of course that we one day can live.
So we have 5 minutes until we'll start taking questions. Please start lining up at the microphones and remember that we are looking for one short and clever question each. So, Reed, on Friday, Groupon is set to go public. Perhaps sometime this month we'll see Zynga going public, two companies you're involved with, I believe. What do you think this broad opening of the IPO window might mean for Silicon Valley? I mean, the last time we saw it during the dot-com days, it created a little over-exuberance.
Well, I think the big difference between, you know, kind of the, you know, 99-2000 exuberance and now is that all of the companies that I think are filing going out have really solid business models, right? That, you know, one might dispute valuation higher, lower, people's decisions about risk factors and growth, because these are all models that are compounding future value in the now. One could have an intelligent disagreement on a spread. But what is categorically different is that there's no question but these companies have solid businesses and have really interesting models that they can potentially run forever and at massive size, and that itself is, like, that they are valuable is not a question. That, you know, how valuable? Well, that's a question of markets and belief in the future and belief in growth and belief in risk discounts, which that's what a market helps you sort out.
There's obviously a lot of talk of bubbles in Silicon Valley. Sometimes I think the primary bubble is the one that insulates us from what's going on in the world. I just walked past the Occupy SF encampment on the way here. Of course, you know, the economies of Europe are melting down. Now, how much does that impact, you know, your guys' lives, your everyday thinking?
Well, for me, I basically pay a lot of attention because I do think that one of the roles that we play here in Silicon Valley is not just as an inventor of technology products that can change the world, but also I think we're inventing new styles of work, how we learn skills, how we invest in ourselves, and how we can apply these to a number of industries, and also, you know, education, government, et cetera. So I pay a fair amount of attention from that point of view. Now, from a LinkedIn perspective, when you're doing these disruptive businesses that kind of bring in categorically new kinds of abilities at a much cheaper price point, like the vast majority of people use LinkedIn for free, et cetera, it doesn't actually affect your business that much and doesn't affect whether or not you hire more engineers, what your future roadmap is. You're still just trying to transform individuals' lives.
I definitely view the world through a bit of a lens of Airbnb because, especially when you're growing as fast as we are, it becomes all-consuming.
Do you even have time to read the paper in the morning?
I don't usually read the paper. I read the New York Times app on the iPads, probably the extent to which I get news and a little bit of tech press. You know, I kind of view, we do hear these issues because we try to stay in touch with our customers. And if you think about it, like, a lot of these things are propagated by people not being able to be able to afford the housing that they have. That's like the biggest asset that they have and sometimes the biggest kind of burden that they have in their lives. So we hear about a lot of this stuff kind of when we started in, like, during the original economic crash in 2008, we started hearing about that. But most of my news comes through our community and not through the mainstream.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, and tonight we're hosting Reed Hoffman and Brian Chesky. I'm Brad Stone of Business Week. Now let's go to audience questions. Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi, I'm Angie. I'm CEO, co-founder of Capsio. So first I would like to thank you, Brian, because while I'm speaking, there is some Russian girl sleeping in my bed in France. and so I'm earning money, so that's cool for a startup. But my question is to Reed. You have made some really good investment. So would you say that you were lucky, or did you find something in common with all these CEOs you founded?
Well, there's always some luck in success. But part of what you do is how do you recognize opportunities and how do you move decisively on them? And so, you know, part of it was realizing that there was going to be a whole nother wave of the consumer internet, that folks who understood, for example, patterns like social, marketplaces, these sorts of things would be the kinds of things that would grow into being huge, partially because I'd had that experience myself. So the short answer is a little of both.
Thank you.
Colton Hicks. Question for either of you two. I'm curious about the creation of a peer-to-peer marketplace. I'm an entrepreneur myself working in the same space out here, pitching investors, creating markets. And I'm curious about what are the principles that underlie people as they transition from a primary market to a secondary market? For example, you know, fermenting from a hotel, a place that you trust as kind of the primary business to consumer provider, transitioning to peer-to-peer. Same thing with PayPal and eBay, from buying something from a company, transitioning to peers. There's obviously value in the large scale, but as people make that behavioral transition, what are the principles that undergird that? How do you make that transition successful?
So Good question. When we first came up with the concept, I tried to pull people that I knew, my sister, my mom, some of my friends, would you ever use this? No way. And so you have two questions you can answer at that point. If they say no, you can either the first question used to be, what do I need to build to make you use this? And that was my original instinct. And I remember talking to one of my friends, and he said, that's the wrong question. Don't ask what you need for them to use your product, because they'll use it when the world uses it. In other words, maybe they're just not early adopters. Find people that will be your early adopters, more adventurous people. If there are none, then you haven't gone far enough. And it turned out that instead of worrying about the mainstream for peer-to-peer marketplaces, because it's a new social behavior, you shouldn't expect that anybody in the world be the first person to start a new social behavior. You should actually find the people that want to be the people to start the new social behavior, because the amount of product and technology you need to build to make it mainstream on day one is probably not feasible. And so we just met our community, we got early adopters, and then as later adopters came, we started building more and more features.
And the one thing I would add to that is adding nodes into the marketplace and having a more distributed, more various, more options in the marketplace, as long as you're preserving trust, as long as you're preserving an ability to make informed decisions and transact, always increases value, generally, I think, super linearly within a system. And that's one of the reasons why the peer-to-peer marketplaces, if you can get them going the right way, are extremely generative.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tim Van Loan. When Peter Thiel and Max Lebchin were here a couple months ago, they were very critical of entrepreneurs who, because of the market and the way that they can get a small amount of investment and then focus on a very small niche and be able to iterate and then, in essence, flip the company or sell the company at a lower valuation, it was actually incenting them to not think revolutionary enough and not be innovative enough, in fact, not changing or affecting the human race, in essence. As an investor, as an entrepreneur, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the high line is I'm almost never critical of entrepreneurs who are building something new that's valuable to customers. I do think that you should, the kinds of projects I get involved in and the recommendation and advice that I give people is if you don't shoot for something really big, you're never going to get there, and so you should do that. Because you shoot for something big and maybe it doesn't work and you get something more moderate size, great. And I think that the question of it being cheaper to start software companies means that there's lots and lots of them, but it also means that there's more chances for the things that build and define these human ecosystems at the scale of millions to hundreds of millions is there. So generally speaking, I'm positive on the fact that more people are launching more companies. I think that's a good thing.
Thank you.
My name is Ethan Austin. Every time I come to one of these events, I meet people and you say, what do you do? And I hear, I am the Airbnb of gourmet cheeses. What, you know, and I think we've seen a lot more of those since the funding round, since the $100 million funding. What is the most interesting or weird Airbnb of X that you've seen or heard?
The Airbnb of toilets?
The Airbnb of toilets.
Hilarious. I think it's a British company. I don't think it's launched yet, but.
The idea there being to crowdsource the location of restrooms?
I suppose, yeah.
I can see how that might
be valuable.
That'd
be the most interesting.
That's a great answer.
All right. First off, Brian, awesome story. Congrats. Going from 200 people to 1,000 people over the next year seems aggressive. Does Reed have you using LinkedIn for all your hiring?
Essentially, I mean, LinkedIn's a very good source for that, but what you do as a board member is you help as much as possible. So you help by trying to solve problems when the problems are brought to you, by asking questions to say, pay attention to these things, by trying to bring people in and resources yourself. You know, one of the things that I actually frequently do during board meetings when they're saying, oh, we're looking for an X, is I start searching LinkedIn myself and forwarding over profiles. You know, as it's kind of an all-hands-on-deck sort of thing. And so, literally none of the companies I'm involved with, except for maybe LinkedIn, has a requirement for using LinkedIn.
But I do use it literally every single day, and we had a board meeting today, and you noticed in the board package there were a lot of LinkedIn profiles there.
I did see that.
So,
thank you, by the way.
Yeah, of course. But I don't have a lot of lessons except that this is what I learned to build a world-class team. It took us 5 months to hire our first engineer, and we met a lot of engineers. The first day I met engineers I could have hired, and they were good. But I realized that it's the difference between, like, I don't know. I guess it's the difference between being in the Army and being like the Navy SEALs, right? Like, there's a certain amount of pride in knowing that you're not just working with good people, you're working with people that are literally the best in the world. And that team becomes a magnet. When I was in college, I wanted to be a designer for Apple. And I wanted to design the iPod. And it wasn't because the devices are cool. It's because I knew those are the 15 best designers in the world. And I'd be a like once-in-a-generation designer if I was on that team. And so we said, we aspire to create a team like that. At least we'll shoot for that. We may not get there, but we'll shoot for that. So it took us 5 months to hire our first engineer, 4 months to hire our next one, maybe 3 months to hire the next one. And now we hire them probably almost every week. The same exact thing now is happening with executive hiring. We spent a really long time trying to find the first one or two people because we think that they set the standard for everyone else. And I think a lot of people that come to interview, they don't just look at how good the company is. They judge the company by the people that interview them. The interviews are really mutual, two ways. And so, one of the questions I asked myself in the back of my mind, if I could hire anybody in the world for this position, would I hire the person sitting across from me? And the only other way I know they're the best in the world is I ask Reed and people like that, who's the best person in the world at this? Like, I'm not saying they're looking for work, but I won't know if the person I'm meeting is the best in the world unless I've met the best person in the world. So I use that to calibrate.
An engineer a week is quite a bit. I know a great tech recruiter if you need one.
Thank you. Next question.
Hey, Brian, can you talk a little bit about the early challenges of distributing a disruptive product and some of the keys to success to actually gain adoption in the mainstream?
Yeah, so marketplaces are incredibly defensible at scale, and maybe it's because they're incredibly hard to start. They're really hard to start. Which is why I think I funded the company with credit cards, and Joe funded the company as well. And I think I personally went 15 or 20K in credit card debt, and it was really hard to get investment early on. And the problem is simple. They call it the chicken and egg problem. Travelers don't want to book homes. Well, they're not going to book homes if there are no homes there. So you try to get the homes, but the homeowners don't want to list their homes unless people are going to book them. So what do? And that was really hard. And we didn't know what to do for a while. We tried a lot of different things. And I can tell you what worked. Summer of 2008, something was happening in the world that everyone was talking about. Barack Obama, Democratic National Convention. The press announces that Barack Obama is moving from a 20,000-seat basketball arena, where I think the Denver Nuggets play, to where the Broncos play, 80,000-seat football stadium. And we said, that's our shot. You have 60,000 people don't have housing. Surely at least a few of them are going to need a place to stay. And it was really in the spirit of the Obama campaign that people wanted to stay with other people, kind of a grassroots movement. And so we went literally. We started with like local people in Denver. Then we started emailing bloggers. We got the bloggers. Then the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News covered us. Then the local ABC and NBC and CBS affiliates. And then Wall Street Journal, then New York Times, and eventually CNN is like in our living room over the course of 3 weeks. And we did that, and it literally went from a matter of 3 weeks, went from a few guys in an apartment, no business, no money, completely broke, with no press, to a few guys in a living room with still no business, no money, still completely broke, maybe even more broke. But now we're on CNN, New York Times, and that kind of started these little, like, infernos. So you start getting a few users here, 100 here, 50 there, 100 there. We did the same thing with the inauguration. And when you have 100 people here and there, then you obsessively meet them. And the great thing, this is the last thing I'll say, is this. One of our other advisors, his name's Paul Graham, he's our first investor, he said, it's better to have 100 people love you than a million people kind of like you. And I took that to heart, and I said, well, I have 100 users, maybe I can get them to love me, because I sure as hell can't find a million people right now. And the reason why is, it's really hard to like have this like really wide, shallow base, and to continue to build off them. You'll never even meet them. But 100 people, you can find out everything they want. Most of these people never even met somebody who started a website. You meet them, you spend a ton of time with them, and once they fall in love with you, literally, as a product, they'll tell every one of their friends. And that's why it took a real long time to start, but it grew much faster later on.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Pierre Simon, French aspiring entrepreneur living in San Francisco. My question goes to Brian. As you talk about the fact that the fast growth of your companies in terms of employees and the fact you're here for the long term, I just had the chance to visit Airbnb's offices last Sundays, and I find out you had a corporate culture officer. So I'd like to know how you intend to build your corporate culture within your company and as it grows.
Building corporate culture.
Oh, corporate culture, sorry. we, before we hired anybody, looked at the companies we admired, and one of them was Zappos. And so before we hired anybody, Jonah and I flew to Zappos, and we got actually a special tour because we were funded by Sequoia, and they're a Sequoia company. So we said, we'll do the tour, but we also want to interview all the people at Zappos who define the culture. So we actually met them. And we learned that they had all these core values. And Zappos created those core values. I think they had 100, 150 people. And we said, we are never going to hire somebody before we have those core values. And so Jonah and I came up with a list of 9 core values. And we said, we're going to measure every single person. And every single person is a measure of those. The first core value is, are they a believer in Airbnb? Are they passionate? And when people interview, I see if they signed up. I see if they've used the product. That's a really important thing. You know, and we've had an incredibly high bar. And you know, when you're growing super fast, the biggest pressure you have is to hire. And the biggest compromise you can make is just to say they're pretty good. But once again, if you truly want to create a special environment where people feel like they're working with the best people in the world, then you have to get used to saying a lot of no's, no matter how painful it is. So that's one of the things. We invest a lot in the office and just making it a really fun environment. But I think at the end of the day, it's really about like obsessively having like a team of advocates that are all believers in the same mission.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hey, guys. My name's Dominic. I'm just another crazy entrepreneur. The question I have is, you know, Brian, you know, it seems like he's so successful because his purpose is so big into this product. I want to know from Reed's standpoint, what do you look at when you look at a company? Is it more purpose than markets? Or what are the main things that you're looking for?
Well, the key things that you're looking for are a vision about, I focus a lot on kind of how consumer internet does build and create human ecosystems, but it's a vision that can scale to massive size. I prefer hundreds of millions, right? If it's tens of millions, that's possible, right? Millions, usually remotely, not as interesting. And then, do they have, you know, these entrepreneurs who are driven with a vision to what to do, are essentially massive, like will learn the game as they play it, you know, like Brian and Joe and Nate. And will they, can it build, once it builds into that ecosystem, is it stable in terms of creating a lot of value? It's one of the reasons, like when I'm asked, it's like marketplaces, networks, platforms. Because if you have those going, they're enormously generative value for everyone in the system. And so those are things I look for. Now, given all of that, one of the things I like about investing a lot is that really smart, driven, creative, brilliant people bring you ideas. And it's not my ideas that I go looking for. It's their ideas. And so sometimes, even off this map, you find somebody's like, oh, wow, that's really great. Like, for example, when I just heard about Airbnb, it's, oh, yeah, it's couch sharing. I didn't really pay much attention. 3 minutes into it, I was like, oh, my God, this is huge. Right? Like, yes, let's do this. This will be great. So,
thank you. Yes.
Hi, my name is Ritu Jain, and I'm a founder of LearningJar.com. Brian, whenever you were talking about the linear growth, right, when you started the company, you're talking about how in your head you're thinking you're going to go through this linear growth and you keep hitting challenges and you want to go faster than you can. That's what I'm going through right now, so with my team of 4 people. Wanted to know, what did you do to overcome that challenge? I mean, I want to go at a fast pace, and I want to make sure my team goes with me. What are some of the things that you do to
So, when you build a marketplace and you have no users, you have a lot of time in your hands.
Yes.
And so we had a lot of time on our hands. And we'd sit in the kitchen late at night wondering why we're not growing fast enough. I have friends. They have millions of users. Why doesn't anyone like us? And I never understood it. Are we not smart enough? Is our product not good enough? Do we not have a good enough idea? And I just replayed that over and over in my head. A couple things made a huge difference for me. One was having really good advisors. And in the early days, I had a startup founder from another Y Combinator company. And I would just, like, meet him every week. And the weekly meetings were a cadence of, like, okay, get to the next meeting. Get to the next meeting. And, you know, each meeting, I just try to show progress. And he's like, don't focus on, you know, how many users you have. Focus on continually making progress. And I think it's actually, looking back, a blessing not having a lot of users. Because you can focus on the few people you have and just constantly just making them fall more in love with your product. And I used to be obsessed with growth, and looking back, it was the wrong thing to focus on.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more quick question.
Great. Hi, guys. My name is Jim, and I coach entrepreneurs in the $1 to $20 million in revenue space. And I'm curious, from your perspective, having gone through that phase of things, you know, often I talk to the people that I work with and say that internally is a reflection of what's going on externally. And I'm wondering some of the internal things that you had to get over yourself. You talked about growing exponentially. You know, how did that show up for you, and how did you get beyond those things?
Well, for us at LinkedIn, basically, more or less, as somewhat atypical for startups, we more or less had stayed on the same plan that we started when we were founded, right? So it was actually, like, for example, one of the things a year and a half ago, we won the HBS Innovative Company or Entrepreneur or something of the Year from Harvard Business School. And Mark Kwame, who is the Sequoia partner, who was the Series A investor, put up our projections for the first 4 years in terms of revenue and all the rest of the stuff. And basically, what we'd made a decision literally a couple of days after we financed, was that we're going to delay everything a year, we're going to only focus on growth because getting critical mass in the network. And then he showed our actual numbers against our plan, and it was like within a variance of about less than 10%. And it was like, I think that was luck, right? But but it was really kind of interesting. And the philosophy of we can transform recruiting, we can transform how individuals figure out skills and invest in themselves, find insight on the web, all these sorts of things, was all part of the initial plan. So that was our experience.
Our vision didn't change, just grew. We started by trying to solve a problem, and since then, it's gone from airbeds in living rooms to bedrooms to then homes to castles, boats. But the vision's always been the same. It's just been expanded. And I think as long as you always focus, it's like kind of like if you're like climbing a mountain, you kind of always know where you're going as long as you don't look down or look behind you. I think you'll keep going there. And if you kind of focus on why you're only here, you're not going to get very far. But, you know, yeah.
So we have time for one more question, and I get to ask it. We end all of our events with this question. Brian Reed, no pressure. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
So one of the things that I didn't expect when I started doing entrepreneurship, I thought education was my cause, and entrepreneurship has become my cause. Because in a world that's increasingly flat, has accelerating time frames, is highly competitive, and it has a need for innovation, it's that ability to create and recreate institutions that I think needs to be applied not only to startup companies, but to large companies, to governments, to education. And so I think entrepreneurship is the answer that we all need to focus much more on. How do we actually spread that, not just from Silicon Valley, but across industries, across regions, and I think we would all be better off with it. So I think that's the less than 60 seconds.
I'm going to think of which one to do. So one of the things that I was very passionate about in college was health and technology. And I think these days, you know, with building a company, we have analytics on everything. We have analytics on our website. We have analytics on our traffic. We have analytics on our dashboard. People are obsessed with how fast our cars can go. And yet our bodies remain this huge mystery to us. And, you know, even, you know, I look at, like, family members and friends, you know, and I realize, like, in myself how little information I have. And I look at, like, how much money we spend every year on health insurance and the medical industry. And I think, you know, people tackling that problem, and imagine, like, Google Analytics for the body. Imagine if every doctor had information and access to your body, how much more empowered we would be.
Let's give a big round of applause to Reed Hoffman and Brian Chesky for sharing their thoughts with us tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.